Bellinger.
Hopefully for Greg Norman. Yes, well done. He's done it at last. Greg Norman, 69. And great stuff. The champion for 1986.
This episode's guest was born in Tamworth, New South Wales in Australia in 1957. He didn't really start playing golf until he was 25 years of age in Canada. He studied biomech in Sydney. After getting his PhD, he was highly sought after by some of the world's best golf coaches and players, including Jim McLean, David Ledbetter, and many, many players. More recently, he collected and started studying data specifically relating to wedge play within 100 yards with Lane Savoy and developed Wedgecraft. The world's leading golf biomechanist, please welcome my friend, Dr. Rob Neal. I'd like to welcome to this episode of Yardage Yarns, Dr. Rob Neal. Dr. Rob would be regarded as the most experienced and sought-after golf biomechanist in the world. Extremely experienced but humble man. So he's given up an ice cream with his friends to do this episode, so we appreciate that, Rob.
Glenn, thank you very much for having me on your little podcast. And I hope that I can provide some nice things for people to take away from it.
They will, I'm sure. So, Rob, start at the start. You were born in 1957 in Tamworth, New South Wales.
That's correct. So I'm a New South Welshman, despite the fact that we didn't win the State of Origin again.
That's right. That's right. So do you follow it over there?
Oh, not particularly well. I occasionally get some jabs from people in Queensland who notoriously let me know when New South Wales loses.
I'm sure they do. Tell me, your father was in education?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was in special education, so he was a director for the Northwest area, and so he would have various special education teachers who would look after children with special needs, but mostly those with learning difficulties. That was the predominant ones. The odd one would be the outstandingly precocious and bright child who needed additional information and so forth to enjoy school, but predominantly those who had learning difficulties.
What was his name?
My mother, Alan Neal.
Alan. And your mum?
My mother was a nurse at the Tamworth Base Hospital, and originally she was in the obstetrics and ward, so she was... A midwife and ran that ward. And then in the later part of her career, she moved to the Burns unit and set up the Burns unit at Tamworth Hospital there, and maybe did that for 15 years before she retired.
Yeah, that's cool. What was her name?
Marie Neal. But in Australia, they would have said Mari. When the whole family moved to Canada, Canadians didn't say Mari, they said Marie, and so she just kept on calling herself Marie after that.
Yeah, right. And how many brothers and sisters?
I have one older brother who lives in California and one younger sister who lives in Brisbane.
Right, so you still got one in Oz and one in California.
Yeah, and both of those siblings of mine are retired, and I'm the middle one, and I'm still working, so I don't know what that tells you.
And what did they do for work?
So my sister had a couple of different careers, but mostly she was in managing workers' compensation cases. So people who had injured themselves at work, and then she became a case manager for them to get them back into the workplace and doing productive things. And my brother started with Monsanto, the big chemical company.
Yep.
And then moved into biotech. So he's a master's degree in plant science, and so, but most of his work was done in sales and marketing, and then he worked as a COO, then CEO of a biotech company, where they were developing drugs or treatment methods for different opportunities. So one of them was, for example, in diabetes.
Yeah, right. Okay. And going back to Tamworth, you started playing golf when you were how old?
I didn't play in Tamworth. I started playing golf seriously when I was about 25.
Oh, right. So, okay.
Yeah, so I'd played a little bit when I was at high school in Canada, but not a very good environment for golf, really. But I got serious after I'd moved to Queensland and decided I didn't want to play competitive basketball anymore. I'd had a good run, played national level, and represented New South Wales at under 20s, and played in the NBL in its early years.
Now it's time for a bit of advertising. I'm particularly excited about this one. A good mate of mine who's an absolute golf tragic and I've coached for years has a little restaurant in Newtown called Cairo Takeaway. The joint is seriously one of my favourites, from meats cooked on the charcoal pit to vegetarian plates and authentic falafels, all washed down with some great local lager. Cairo Takeaway is located on 81 Enmore Road, Newtown, only a gap wedge away from Enmore Theatre. Oh yeah, and Hesh, the owner, asked me to let you know, if you're ever driving down past Cairo Takeaway and see him, toot and come in. Get it? Toot and come in? Toot and Carmen? All right, back to the show.
But I've been pretty much injury-free, and so I thought, you know, I'm starting out my master's and PhD, it would be really dumb to blow out a knee and to have an injury that I would carry for the rest of my life when I wasn't really going to be competitive anymore in basketball, not big enough, and the game just really grew in the years around 1980 onwards. A lot of Americans and Europeans started migrating to Australia to play in the National League, and the size of the players just got bigger and bigger, and I knew that, hey, although I was quick, I wasn't as good as those guys.
Yeah, right.
So I started playing golf and played tennis a little bit that year, but I liked golf better. And so I decided to try to see how good I could get at golf. And then I ended up using the golf swing as an activity to study over my academic career.
Because of the complexities of it? Is that why you chose the golf swing?
Well, I was interested in golf and it's an activity where there had been done, there'd been quite a bit of work, research work done, but nothing that had been in 3D when I started doing that. And then it also was one of those activities where you were trying to really move and implement as fast as you can, but with some modicum of control. But you were doing that in a very constrained area, not like on a tennis court or a tennis serve might have been appropriate, but any of the other ground strokes in tennis, you know, you're running to position yourself to receive the ball and those sorts of things. So golf, you know, it was pretty stationary, so it was easy to set up an environment that was consistent with what people would actually do on the golf course.
So that
was part of the reason. So the logistics of it and basically the interest that I had in how segments of the body are coordinated to create high speed at the end of these linkages.
And try and make it repeatable, right?
Yes, exactly, yeah. So,
And whereabouts in Canada? Whereabouts in Canada were you?
I lived in a place that I call Winterpeg. It's actually Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, yeah.
Because it seemed to be so flipping cold there for so long. It's right in the middle of the country, about 100 kilometres north of the Canadian-US border. And so it's bitterly cold in the wintertime and then gets quite warm in the summer, but it's a windy place as well in the summertime.
Yeah, right. So, my son lives in Revelstoke. He was in Banff for a while.
Oh, right, okay.
And
that's a nice part of Canada.
Yeah, it's beautiful. We were just over there. It's snowboarding and we jumped in the frozen lake. It's a beautiful place. It was cold. Wim Hof, we jumped in. It was bloody cold, I tell you. Now,
I can imagine.
And why did you go to Canada? Your dad's work or?
Yeah, so dad, they were looking for people in special education, and it was supposed to be a one-year kind of sabbatical for him. And a great experience for the family to go over there and live in a different country and different environment. And it turned out that after 6 years they returned, and 6.5 years I came back to do my university work in Australia. My brother stayed, and my sister stayed for an extra year to finish high school, and then she came back to Australia also. So
yeah, right. And
that was the journey.
Yeah, right. Forgot to mention before when you were talking about basketball in the NBL, you know Paul Smith, who used to work for the PGA. He was our trainee coordinator when I was a trainee. You know Paul?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He owns the Sydney Kings now.
Oh, is that right? Well, he's done better financially than any of us, hasn't he?
He's done very, very well. I want to get him on the podcast, actually. Yeah, he's done extremely well. Nice guy. Okay, so now you have a PhD, which you studied at which university?
I did my PhD at the University of Queensland.
Queensland,
and then ended up working there as a lecturer and then senior lecturer until I left there in 2000. So, you know, the typical subjects that I would teach were physics, biomechanics, statistics, research design, both undergraduate and then graduate level. And I kind of developed the undergraduate program when the Human Movements Studies Department was going through transition. So it was a good time to be there. But it was also a good time to leave. So I had a nice career there and then turned my hand to trying to grow a small business and bring a technology to golf that hadn't been around before. And so it provided some wonderful experiences, some interesting challenges, and obviously some frustrations along the way, as any new business
would. Yeah, exactly. And when did you meet your wife in this journey?
So I met her in 1996.
Just before this, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I was still working as a university lecturer, and she is a podiatrist.
What's her name?
But she came back, Karen. Karen Harrison.
Yep.
So Karen came to the university to do some postgraduate work in exercise physiology. That's how we ended up meeting, and then subsequently to that, we lived in Australia and she was working there while I was working there. And then when we moved to the US, she came over with me.
Right. But she's an Aussie.
She's an Aussie, yeah. Yep. A local Queenslander from Brisbane.
Yeah, right. So a New South Welshman with a Queenslander.
Yeah, that's right.
Scary. That is scary.
It's not like going to Ireland and having a Northern Irish.
Yes,
Catholic,
yes.
And
yeah. Often, it's quite a thing. Now, who?
So her father is actually from Northern Ireland.
Oh, right. Right. So your wife's father and Rory's grandfather might have had a beer together. Who knows? Now, who were the first golf coaches in Australia that you clearly remember supporting you or showing interest in what you were doing?
Well, there were two that clearly come to mind. And a third one who was a little after the other. So Mark Holland was the AIS coach.
Yep.
At about the time that I started Golf Biodynamics.
Yep.
And he really gave me the first opportunity to come and work with the development players in the AIS squad. And from there it spread out. Peter Knight was a very good advocate as well. And that was when he was with N-Swiss. And Steve Bann, who was at
VIS.
Victorian Institute, yeah, at that time. And so those were the really early days. The technology was decent. The software was just adequate in those days. But at least they gave me the opportunity to have a look at what things were possible using the 3D motion capture systems that we were developing. And eventually, most of the academies of sport on the eastern seaboard of Australia came on board, and then I did work with development squads in the various states as well. So it was the elite level coaches who gave me the opportunity. And I have to be somewhat complimentary to the Australian PGA too, because they gave me an opportunity to speak at some events and education events for professionals. And so that was a chance to showcase the technology as well.
Yep.
And maybe in hindsight, because you probably remember this, Glenn, in Sydney, I think it was maybe 2001, there was a coaching conference on, and I managed to maybe polarize the audience by putting up some videos. I remember this distinctly, and asking these people, where the ball went, and just based on the swings.
Yeah.
And so, realistically, you couldn't tell where the ball went because we didn't have technologies there. And I just wanted to let people know that, hey, you can see both these swings, they're both good swings, but you have no idea where the ball went just based on what the swing was doing.
Yeah.
So it was meant to be as a little teaser to say, look, we need to understand more accurately what the body's doing, and then we have a better chance of understanding what the potential ball flight would be and so forth. And so it was really actually beneficial for me when launch monitors came along. So now we could actually measure the club delivery and what the ball did simultaneously with either video or 3D motion capture that I was developing. So it was a really kind of exciting time technologically in the early 2000s through to about 2010 when FlightScope and TrackMan were developing their products.
Yeah, I remember. And another name that comes to mind with you, was Jim McLean one of the first coaches in the US that you got involved with?
Well, yes, definitely. So in about 2002, I realized that the Australian golf market just wasn't big enough for the sort of stuff that we were developing. We'd captured about most of the elite level golf in Australia, the programs and so forth. But it wasn't really what I had intended when I left the university. I wanted to build a business where I would sell the hardware and license the software to golf professionals, because I thought this was the next best thing to slice bread for them. They could finally evaluate what players did. They could measure change, and they could really show how efficacious their coaching was.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it almost went the other way. It also backfired in the sense that it also could show that someone didn't change and that their coaching wasn't very good. And people threatened by that, I think. So it was clear that this market wasn't big enough and had to go to a bigger market. And so what better one to go to than the US? And so hats off to Jim McLean. He was the guy who really gave us the opportunity to grow the business in the US. So I contacted David Ledbetter, Jim, Butch Harmon, you know, the big names, and tried to pitch to them that, you know, we could come over and help them with their school business and coaching business. And Jim has always been very innovative in his thinking and kind of ahead of the curve that way. So it was a really good fit, and we had a great 12 or 13 years with him at Doral. So, yeah.
And did you do work with the others you mentioned, Harmon and Ledbetter? Or
I've done work with David, but not Butch.
Yeah, right.
Work with Butch. Yep. Yeah. And then, I mean, there was a bit of argy-bargy amongst those big names anyway, right?
Yeah.
Professional jealousy sort of thing. So it wasn't like Jim would be very happy if I went down the road and talked to Led and
worked with him and stuff.
So I was pretty loyal to Jim. I was very loyal to Jim throughout the years that I was at Doral. And so we had a great relationship, and we still are good friends to this day. But after 13 years, it was time to move on and look at different opportunities. And those 13 years in the US provided me with tremendous opportunities to network and develop relationship with golf coaches throughout primarily the Northeast, so the eastern seaboard of the US up through to Boston, and you know, some other places, those spatterings in California and Texas, but primarily the East Coast. That's where McLean's network was the strongest. But without his help, we just would not have been able to survive. It's as simple as that.
And, yeah, I'm sure. And he's such a lovely man too. I've had dinner with him. He's just a true gentleman, and no ego with Jim. That's what I admired.
Yeah, I mean, he's obsessed with golf.
Yeah.
And remains obsessed with golf. I mean, I can remember going over to his house and having dinner with him, and then afterwards, you know, he's going through memorabilia and
loves it,
magazines and stuff like that. Just like it's 24/7, you know. And to be honest, I need a break from golf at times. So I try to have some other things going on. And
him and I wouldn't stop. We'd be absolutely terrible together, him and I. So
yeah, exactly. So.
Which players, if you're allowed to name them, or which ones are you allowed to name, that have personally engaged your services over the years? Like, as you know, as Tiger or someone said to you, I want to spend 3 days with you at home, or?
So I've never worked with Tiger, but I've worked with quite a number of the players whom you would see near the top of the FedEx Cup list today. So Justin Rose, Rory McIlroy, Justin Thomas, Brooks Koepka, and Max Homer, and it's a pretty extensive list.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, like if you go back, I've been doing this stuff for 25 years now, Glenn. So you go back, I've worked with Norman, I worked with Seve before he passed away,
right,
with Nick Faldo, champions from previous generations. So it's a long list of highly skilled players, Ryder Cuppers like Luke Donald and Tom Kite even.
But you've been given – well, the list is incredible. But the other thing is you've also been exposed to not only the movement patterns and sequence and 3D biomechanics, but also – you know, when you talk about Seve or any of these good players, there's another component, which is feel and awareness and the artistry of it. So that would be something that you couldn't probably quantify in words, but truly amazing to see both sides of it. You can read the data and the detail.
Yeah, I mean, I often use this line, and maybe I need to credit Mark Holland for this, or it's an adaptation of what he said to me, because he talked about it as video, and he said, You know, Rob, when I look at someone's swing or their short game or their putting, whatever, and I might video them and I draw some lines on the video or on the TV as it was back in those days, that's how I kind of look at the swing. I have a framework and I look at it. And then I say, yeah, that's right, because when I look at a swing, I see graphs that depict certain movements and segments moving relative to each other and so forth, and how the body's rotating as it's swaying and dropping and lifting and those sorts of things. But at the end of the day, the player's golf swing is what he or she feels. So we always need to be able to transform whatever medium through which we see a person's golf swing into what they feel or how they feel. So the art of good coaching is about being able to get them to elucidate and get in touch with what their swing feels are on that day, or the, you know, you make a change. And what does that change feel like? Because if it doesn't feel any different, you can probably rest assured that it wasn't any different.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there is no change. So I think that was one of the lessons that I learned early on, that you have to, it's no good talking about a 90-degree shoulder turn or a 60-degree pelvis rotation or a 10-centimeter hip slide if you can't put that into something that's going to help change the feel. And that was one of the really neat things about the technology that we developed, Glenn, was that we had access to real-time audio feedback. So you could set zones or positions in space, and when a player moved into that zone, there would be an audio sound made to let them know this is where you need to be. And it allowed them to then understand what a 90-degree turn or a 4-inch hip sway or a zero thrust feels like, because that's when learning can be accelerated. When they start to change the feel, then you can change the movement pattern. So that was one of the really neat things about the electromagnetic technology that we developed and continue to use.
Yep, well said. And another player that comes to mind for some reason is Tom Kite. Now, for the listeners, you know this, Rob, but for the listeners, Tom Kite, I'm pretty sure, was the first player to win $1 million in a season on tour, which was a lot of money back then. Mm-hmm. He was the first guy, I'm pretty sure, to use a lob wedge, a 60-degree wedge.
That's correct.
That would have been what, back in the early 80s or something like that?
No, it was late 70s.
Late 70s, late there 70s. You go. Late 70s. Yep. And to think that a player could come along and think, I need more loft, Titleist or whoever back then would have thought he was mad.
Yeah.
You know, we've got
the one who built it. 60-degree wedge.
Well, there you go. So my memory serves me. But I wanted to take a short break from the show to let you know about our friends at Brisbane East, Gold Coast and Sydney South Commander Business Centres. If you own or run a business, let them do a health check on your business communications. The worst thing that could happen is you find out that your current deal is okay. And if you sign up at one of these three centres, you'll receive a 50-inch plasma TV. Offering Ericsson LG solutions, contact one of these Commander Business Centres today. And then you, of course, more recently in the last, how many years it been since you founded Wedgecraft with Lane Savoy?
Lane Savoy, yeah. So yep. About 8 years ago we started that. And so we took a big, deep dive into wedge play. And that was, I mean, obviously the experiences and technology that I developed for full swing and for putting along the way was tantamount to being successful to develop the Wedgecraft platform, which what we decided was, look, there's a lot of anecdotal information available for short game work, but there was very little evidence to support the systems, the concepts, the ideas that people put forward. And so we embarked on a journey to measure as many of the greatest wedge players we could get our hands on and find out what they did. And then really to determine what are the characteristics that are similar or amongst this group of really highly skilled wedge players, of which Brett Rumford is one of them, a good old Aussie.
Yep.
And then put that into a form that people could digest and understand, hey, these are the principles that you need to adhere to if you want to become good at finesse in the finesse wedge zone or the distance wedge zone, because these are the things that all of the good players do.
Yep.
Irrespective of slight nuances and, you know, idiosyncratic things that they do, they all do fundamentally these types of things. And so that became then really the foundation of what we would coach or tell people to do when it came to short game shots. And so it really helped us to understand, deeply understand things. So we went to the RNA and did research with them. I went to Sydney and saw a fellow by the name of Rod Cross, who's probably the world's expert on what I'll call oblique impacts. His most of his work was done with tennis rackets and balls, but you know, he did some stuff in golf, and he really enjoyed working with us on understanding the physics of impact and different golf balls on clubs and when they land on greens and things like that.
Yeah,
he did a whole bunch of modeling. Yeah, so we learned a ton along the way about practically applying the physics or the mechanics, and then being able to use it in a form that would help golfers. That was our ultimate goal, but not just help golfers, Glenn, to really help golf coaches as well, to make sure that they were telling their players the right stuff to do, not just, oh, well, this is what I feel like I do.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what you need to do.
Right? Yeah. That's right. So,
that was the foundation of wedgecraft.
And because Mark Brody, when he developed strokes gained, and most of the listeners will be familiar with the concept of if you hit it closer or you hit it further off the tee, the stats tell us that you're in a better position to score for your putt for your next shot, in other words. But I've always thought, well, that's great across the board or conceptually, but you still need to know what to do with a wedge to get your ball close, right?
Well, that's exactly right, yeah. Just as an aside, Mark Brody and I are really good friends. I often stay at his place when I go to New York.
Right.
Yeah.
So we
play golf pretty regularly. Probably play a couple of times, maybe three times each year when I go up to New York. So
that's cool. Where's he a member at?
You remember at a private club up in New York called Pelham Country Club.
Pelham.
First place, actually.
Yeah, right. I'll look it up. And what's your handicap these days?
Oh, I still get it pretty close to even par. I just got back from Sage Valley. I played three times while I was up there, and I shot one under the first round, about four over the second round, and about even par the third round.
There you go. So you've still got it.
Yeah, but that's not from the back tees anymore, Glenn.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Long as you're enjoying your golf, and you don't have to tell anyone. I'll edit that out. You don't need to tell anyone that. We'll tell them it's from the tips.
No, it's definitely not from the tips. I don't hit it far enough. I mean, I still have pretty good speed. Like, I swing it at about 107, 108 on the golf course, club head speed with the driver. So it's decent for an old guy like me. But
you go, all right. And the couple of other questions, specific questions I've got. What are the big take-homes for the listeners your average club golfer, what are the big take-homes that you've learnt from studying wedge play? What are some obvious, or not so obvious, actually, sorry, things that you would tell your average golfer?
Okay, I'll try a few things. Firstly, understand that there are different types of wedge shots, and we'll talk about the finesse wedge zone. That's all of those little shots around the green, chip shots, short pitch shots, that sort of stuff. And then distance wedges are more in the order of 50 meters and longer, where you're making a pretty decent swing at a ball, and you're trying to hit at a specific distance. And or fairway wedges, that's sometimes called. I don't like the fairway wedge term that much because you hit these from the rough as well. But anyway, so first thing, on an equipment side of it, if you want to get tour-level performance, you need to use tour-level equipment, which yep. means a quality golf ball. Now, I obviously prefer Titleist as the golf ball
yep.
and Vokey as the wedges, but there are other good companies that provide high-quality equipment.
Yep.
Secondly, you must learn to lean the shaft forward with your wedge if you're going to hit good distance wedge shots.
Yep.
Because if you can't lean the shaft forward sufficiently, the ball will slip on the face and you won't be able to create spin.
Yep.
And spin is your biggest friend in short game.
Yep.
In colloquial or simplistic terms, spin is what stops the golf ball on the green. In technical terms, it's not spin, but that's all right. The more yep. spin you have, the better you'll be able to stop your golf ball
yep.
near where it lands. So then you can get good at predicting, if I land it here, it's going to stop within 2 or 3 meters of where it lands, and that way you can improve your proximity and therefore get better at golf. So that's a big thing. If you don't ever learn how to lean the shaft forward, you're always going to have trouble in the wedge zone, in the distance wedge zone particularly, because you'll have trouble with contact. So a shaft that's delivered vertical or near vertical, it's really hard to get that leading edge underneath the golf ball and create the right conditions to create spin and deliver the club properly.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of the distance wedge zone. In the short
finesse
wedge zone, yeah. So there are a couple of really important things to recognize. And probably greatest credit goes to Brett Rumford and Tom Kite and Luke Donald in this space. Not that they actually told me what they did, but we measured them and then went, wow, this is very different to what everyone tells you to do.
Yep.
So I'm going to speak as a right-hander here, Glenn.
Yep.
So on the backswing, you need to move your upper and lower center, so the middle of your sternum, middle of your pelvis, needs to move to your left toward the flag on the backswing, and down a little bit.
Yep.
And then on the downswing, you need to stay there, maybe go a little bit further left, rotate your body, and rise up. So you've got to extend your chest, and your head needs to come up. It needs to be higher at impact than it was at setup.
Yep.
And it's almost the antithesis of what old school coaching short game was, where you had to stay down to secure contact. You had to play the ball back in your stance. All of those sorts of things lead to typical high precision requirements for delivering the club, which for most golfers is a problem. And therefore, you develop all sorts of anxiety that goes with poor contact and invariably not very good shots ahead. So that would be the biggest thing. So move left and down and then rotate up and stay left as you move through the downswing. And it's better, you're better off on all of those little finesse wedge shots to do it with minimal wrist hinge.
Yep. Like so we see Jason Day do.
JD, Steve Stricker, Luke is almost that way. He has a little bit of hinge, but not a lot. So there's a lot of width down the bottom of the arc. So it gives you a bigger margin for error when landing the club on the ball and the turf.
Yep, yep, yep. More reliable under pressure.
Yep, definitely. Yep.
And do you think these guys, because you mentioned three, I think you said Rumford, Donald, was it, who else, Kite,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So did these guys develop this through practice? Like, why do they all do it?
I think, and I don't know for sure, but I think it's because they figured out that this is the best way to do it. To get reliable contact and be able to deliver the club with all of the various nuances or the variations needed to hit a whole variety of different trajectory shots in the finesse wedge zone. So it's a very different beast that you're dealing with here, because let's say then you've got your 7-iron in your hand. How far do you hit your 7-iron?
145 meters. So what's that? 160.
Yeah, 160. So you go. You, every time you get hit a 7-iron, you're trying to hit it about 145 meters.
Yeah.
Right. You know, a couple of yards or meters difference. That's okay. Like if you hit it 147 or 144, that's fine, and it's all very close to that 145 that's your carry distance with your 7-iron. Okay, so think about a wedge. You would hit that somewhere, let's go to your 60-degree wedge. What's the maximum distance you would hit it?
Oh,
70 meters?
Yeah, not far. Yeah, maximum would be 80, max.
Yeah. But you'll use that same club all the way down to maybe a 10-meter or 5-meter chip shot.
Yep.
So you've got to learn to use this one implement to cover this vast array of differences in trajectory, spin, and delivery. So you know, you would, how many times are you going to line up your 7-iron with a leading edge that's 20 degrees open, Glenn?
Never. Or me, but, me maybe every yeah. now and then, but everyone else never. But, no, you're right.
Yeah, but if you're going to become a good wedge player, you need to learn how to do that. And maybe it's you've got to learn to go to 40 degrees yeah. open with the leading edge, or 50 or 60, depending on how high you want to hit a shot, or you know, hitting a bunker shot, things like that. You just would never do that with a 7-iron. So there's this really huge array of shots that you need to become familiar with and learn how to execute. And our teachings and what Lane and I advocate is that you have a standard technique, this Steve Stricker, Jason Day type technique, where there's not a lot of wrist hinge, but then you make variations at setup or you do different things at set up your body, where the ball's positioned and how the club is delivered, to be able to basically make the same movement but get a different trajectory and different spin on the golf ball.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think the stuff that we strongly believe in is effective, because you can develop a technique that works probably for 90% of the shots that you would face within 50 yards of the green.
And are you an advocate for not hitting your wedges flat out?
Oh, definitely.
Because yeah. I've never liked, like personally my own game, I when I was a trainee, so we're talking 30 years ago sort of thing, I was even before Pels came along, I came up with a little system for myself where I swung each of my wedges from hip height to chest height to shoulder height. That's just what I called it in my mind. And I grabbed each of my wedges. I've always carried four wedges my whole life because I came back, you know, like you're talking about late 70s for Tom Watson. So by the time I was trainee in 1988 or something, 89, it was 10 years later. So I carried four wedges. But basically, I determined if I – or I worked out on my own through trial and error. If I keep the swing speed the same, if I keep the swing the same and I change clubs, I'll get different distances. And it was just a very basic way for me to try and determine how could I get different trajectories and different reactions on the green without changing too many things, if I could.
Yeah, exactly. So I would say most coaches advocate for something like that, some sort of system where, you know, it's hip height, shoulder height, armpit, mid ribs, or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of a feel, and I like the way you put it. So this is what I perceive that I did. You might video and say, "Well, that's not nothing like that," but that's okay. It's your perception.
Yeah.
And then I go, "All right, I'm going to finish and at mid rib height here on this shot, and with my 55 degree wedge, it's going to go X number of yards." So I think that's part of becoming an elite level golfer, is to develop those systems that help you to know how far you hit these shots. I would say for the club level golfer, they'd be way better off not swinging anywhere near 100% with their wedges. Use the four wedges or three minimum in the bag. And if it's, you know, if it's a 90-meter shot, don't try to hit your 60-degree wedge or your 58-degree wedge that distance. That's just not appropriate. Hit a 54-degree wedge or a 52 or a 50, whatever is appropriate for you, given your club head speed, because it's much easier to control the delivery of the club and the shaft lean when you're swinging at, let's call it, 80% of your maximum speed, than when you're going at it flat out.
Yeah.
And I think what happens when people start swinging too hard for, you know, with their wedges, they end up extending their lead wrist too early, they deliver too much loft, and they lose control of trajectory and direction.
And contact on the face.
Yep, on the face, yep. Yep, it's really hard then to get that nice centered contact, for sure. Well done.
So what they think they gain, I often say in lessons, what you're all about hitting it further, but I've never heard a good player walk off the course and say, "Do you know how far I hit my gap wedge today?" No one cares exactly how far you hit your gap wedge. They proximity and consistency, that's all they care about.
Yep.
So just another topic before I let you go. I've always loved Mo Norman from when I very first read articles about him when I was probably a long time ago now, 18 or something. And after I booked this in with you to do the podcast, I noticed it popped up somewhere that you'd spent some time with Todd Graves, which they call, for the people at home, Little Mo, which he spent about 10 years being Mo Norman's shadow. If you don't know who Mo Norman is, you need to Google it and watch some videos. Amazing character and ball striker and consistent player. But so tell me a little bit about the data you received and your thoughts on the single plane swing.
So the quick summary is this, there's some, you know, differences at setup. Mo Norman didn't set the club right behind the ball. He claimed, "Oh, the hardest thing in golf is that first 12 inches. So I just started 12 inches behind." You know, he was on the spectrum, Mo Norman, just for those people who didn't. So, and then the hands were very high, a bit like Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah.
Current player. And so that changes, you know, where in space the hands move on the backswing. But in reality, when you look at what happens on the downswing, and then I have the data on Todd to verify yep. this, it's just like any other good ball striking. Mm-hmm. So they have the appropriate sequence. They deliver shaftly. They, you know, their wrist angles are very stable. Body rotation through the ball. So I would say rotationally, they aren't as high as I would call modern day swings, like a Rory McIlroy or Wyndham Clark or Dustin Johnson. Those guys really rotate much more than Mo Norman did. But not everyone on tour swing looked like those three that I just named either. So
no, that's
it's
right.
not like that's the only way you can swing a golf ball, in modern golf. But there are characteristics that you need to adhere to. Like you need to be able to shift pressure, push into the ground, rotate your body at least a certain amount, stabilize the wrists, and all of those sorts of things. And maybe part of what Mo Norman learned how to do was like he was an amazingly consistent ball striker, but he wasn't what you'd call a really high speed player. He didn't hit the ball that far.
Yeah,
hit it unbelievably straight, but not that far. Not short, but not.
Yeah, I understand. Without that rotation and length of swing, because obviously he swung it short without a lot of rotation, so his pelvis and his knees went more lateral with a bent left knee, what he felt, as opposed to a Rory who was rotating 100 miles an hour and ripping that club head through. So more powerful, but would you say for a lot of golfers, having spent time, did you spend a fair bit of time with Todd?
I've probably spent, maybe 8 to 10 days.
Oh, a fair while, right. And is there merit in what they do, in your professional opinion, like reduce the moving parts and make it a little bit simpler for your average player?
I'm not convinced about that.
Yeah, right.
But that's true. I think that good coaching, good instruction doesn't rely on trying to develop or create a system that's just different to someone else's so that you can get some notoriety for it. I think that there are fundamental things that everyone needs to do to be able to hit the ball effectively, and it can look like Jim Furyk, or it can look like Todd Graves, or it can look like Rory McIlroy. Yeah. They're all similar things in terms of how they deliver the club and hit their body. So.
And you don't care which one it looks like, as long as it's mindful with that player and their requirements and what they can repeat and feel and how they learn and go from there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not going to prescribe that you need to swing like Mo Norman. That to me makes no sense, because you might not have a body that's set up to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I mean, for sure, I'm probably not going to tell people that they need to swing like Rory McIlroy either. Most people don't have a body that would allow them to do that.
Yeah.
But I would say, hey, let's pick out the key elements of a golf swing, what I call the immutable aspects of a swing, and build those into what you can do, whether that's a 70 degree or an 80 or a 90 or a 100 degree shoulder turn. We'll build the characteristics that are going to make you effective through impact.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, I gave two lessons in a row last week, and the first one was a young kid who I teach a fair bit, and he's got a strong grip, and he swings it like Dustin Johnson, and I like it, and I think that's how he's going to play his best golf. And then the very next lesson, which I wouldn't have been able to do 20 years ago, the next lesson through mobility or whatever is an older golfer, and I thought Mo was perfect for him. Less rotation,
yeah.
Face square, mm-hmm. longer through impact, and they both walked away happy. I'm like, wow, well, you need to know a fair bit about the game to be able to match all that up, you know, from one lesson to another.
That's exactly right. That's a good example for your audience. It's you know, Glenn is not going to come down and say, well, you need to swing like so-and-so, and that works for 1% of the population, but what about the other 99%? So we need to get something that's going to be effective for you.
Well, the player, I always say, the player's the boss, not me. Like, you're the one that goes away and has to deal with this stuff under pressure on the course and the frustrations of the game and the lack of time that's required to make change and all that sort of stuff. So at the end of the day, I say, look, you've got to make the ultimate decision. I'll answer questions and guide you or try and help you or care about you, but it's your game. It's not mine. Like, I'm not, you know, while you're out there trying to hit fairways on a Sunday morning, I'm asleep. So you need to take control here, not me.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really valid point, is that, like, for an amateur golfer to make changes to their golf swing is a really, really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Because they just typically don't have the time and maybe the motivation to go through the pain of change, because invariably, if you're making changes to a pattern of movement that's already established, it is going to, you're going to have this period where your golf score and ability kind of regresses until you become good at doing the new
activity. That's right. And if you only quarter get the job done and it doesn't work, then you turn around and blame the thing that you haven't even built for being the problem.
Yeah, that's not the problem. The problem is that you didn't put enough time to become an expert in that. Yeah,
or understand it enough, or all that.
Yeah. And look, it's just such a hard thing to do, to make movement pattern changes. They're really resistant to change. You think about, like, how long has it been since you rode a bicycle?
A little while, maybe 6 months.
Yeah, you would have no problem just jumping up on the bike and riding it, because you learned how to ride a bike when you were young.
Yeah.
And so it's in there. And your brain just calls it up as soon as you jump on a bike.
Yeah.
And in fact, people who haven't ridden for 20 years can jump up on a bike. They might be a little unsteady at first and they'll go, oh, yeah, I've got this. Go. So a golf swing is a bit like that. Once you've got it learned in there, that's what the brain goes to. And so now you go, oh, but we need to do this differently. And it's maybe only subtly different in a sense, but it feels completely different. And that can make you so much more effective as a player and a striker of a golf ball if you make those changes. But I tell you, it's hard work to make
not that
changes.
Easy. Yeah, that's right. I have where I coach, I need to get it laminated and put, because I'm teaching at two facilities now, but I have a list. It's like, what would you call it, like a hierarchy of how you improve at golf, and I often just, you know, explain to my clients, this is how I do it. I have a lesson, or I get some information off a friend or whatever it is, or TrackMan data, whatever it is. So I get an idea of what I should be working on, and then I practice at home without a ball, without pressure, like swinging in the backyard, and then I hit some balls on the range without targets, then I introduce a target, and then I go and play some holes alone, and it goes down the list of, you know, slowly introducing more targets, more pressure, et cetera, et cetera, whereas the last thing is, you know, competing on the list, and I often draw an arrow from lesson and competing and say, this is how people make change. They come to a lesson and they want to play in the club championships tomorrow. And you're like, there's eight other steps in here that you need to consider and understand, and you need time and you need patience and you need repetition and you need perseverance.
People?
Yeah, you need support. Yeah, there's a lot of little steps there, whereas, and they look at it and they think, yeah, wow, that's where I'm in trouble. I have a lesson and then I expect to play well on Saturday. That's it.
Yep.
And as you know, you often say to people, well, this information that you want from me, how much time and effort, like, you know, if you have two jobs and six kids and two mortgages and
yeah,
and you're off a 21 handicap, but you want to make this change by next Saturday. That's very difficult.
So you can tell people that you can help them, but you're not a miracle worker.
That's right. And I always say, if I had a magic pill, I would have overdosed on it anyway. So you wouldn't have any left.
Right.
You wouldn't have any left. Rob, thank you very much. We've hit an hour. Really appreciate you. You be asked to do this sort of thing a lot. My listeners will and sponsors will appreciate it. The PGA have been great supporters recently, so they'll appreciate it. I'll let them know that it's out there. They'll probably put it on the PGA website. But continue to do all the good work that you do. It'll never be forgotten, I can promise you that. You probably don't understand that, you truly don't, but it's like Ramsey, right? Ramsey McMaster's long gone, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But the things that you guys do, you wouldn't appreciate, because you're not, there's thousands and thousands and thousands of golf coaches, there's not thousands of golf biomechanists, especially not experienced ones like you. So on behalf of the Australian PGA and all our coaches over here, thanks for everything you've done and keep up the good work.
All right, mate. Well, thank you very much, Glenn. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Speak soon.
You've been listening to another episode of Yardage Book Yarns. Don't forget to share it with your friends, and we'll see you next time.